you. My name is Nicolette. I'm an alcoholic. Do I need to say that again? I'm Nicolette. I'm an alcoholic. Nice to be back with you. Third week now. My goal was to do how it works. I knew that I wanted to cover the third step, which we talked about the last 2 weeks, and I purposely stopped at the beginning of the fourth step, and I'm hoping that we can like get through this chapter today. Last week I ended with this sentence, which I think speaks volumes, really speaks volumes about what we suffer from. And I think it's a really, really important pointer out of the book, that self manifested in various ways is what defeated us. And I think that that's like so poignant, you know, it's so, everything I know about my alcoholism, all the reflections I have about the dynamics of my life and the roles that I have played and that I've assigned to you and to myself in the drama of life were really just self trying to survive and protect itself, you know? And the book really like introduces it, that really leads us into that. Like, you know, I talked about being convinced of the ABCs was really, really important. So with that, with this like step one experience of powerlessness that gives me desperation and willingness of a drowning person to step into the unknown, to be willing to get into a relationship with a God of its understanding. You know, I come to this place to take a look at, but what about the way I relate to myself, to you guys, and to life in general, or to God, blocks me from being the most genuine, the most honest, the most present person I can be in life, which equals the most alive. Not needing to numb myself, not needing to run, not needing to escape anything or any emotion or any feeling or any story in my head. And then the book says, self manifested in various ways is what defeated me. And if I believe that, especially by the time I'm in this point, and I have a sense of that, right? I sense that because I've failed. I got myself into a corner wanting to commit suicide, unable to get off the floor, drinking myself to death, right? I failed at managing life. I want to take a look at that. And then it goes, resentment is the number one offender. It's on page 64 on the bottom. It doesn't say alcohol is the number one offender. It says resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Do I believe that? Do I believe that is a great question for me. From it stem all, not some, all forms of spiritual disease. For we have not been only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we strengthen up mentally and physically. This was true for me only after doing inventory and maturing somewhat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believed it. I didn't have this kind of faith. I believed my sponsor. I believed the big book. I believed your experience. But to me, this was Japanese when I first read it. Not really sure. Don't have a reference point. Okay, I'm cornered enough that I believe this. But now it is true more than ever for me. And I have it in my own personal experience how resentment shuts me off from an ability to really meet life in a genuine way. It closes me up. It shuts me down. I put the blinders on. I'm wrapped up in the story. I'm not really present for life. I'm not really available. I'm not fluid. I'm not flexible. I'm not teachable. When I'm in resentment, I am righteous. I'm a victim. I am angry. And that really doesn't allow me access to gratitude. It doesn't allow me access to the heart. I'm not soft in the heart. I'm not seeing your point of view. I'm not compassionate, right? I can't really tap into life when I'm like that because I'm trying to run the show. because I think that it's my way. My way is the best way. It really excludes any other possibility. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry, and we asked ourselves why we were angry. These are the first two columns of the resentment inventory. I was given a four-column inventory, some paper and a pen, and I was told to write. I was told to pray for the truth before I wrote, to communicate with this God that I decided to get into a relationship with, to write every single day, and I was given a timeline on how long to write, because I will drag that stuff out forever. I noticed that suddenly I took afternoon naps. Suddenly I was willing to do everybody's chore in the sober house I lived in, not just mine. And suddenly I binge watched Law and Order, all the series. I'm a New Yorker. I never watched Law and Order in New York City. I watched Law and Order in a small sober house in a room in Dover, New Jersey, in my early recovery. And I was honest enough to use the payphone and tell that to my sponsor, even though I was embarrassed and I wanted to impress her and I wanted to be a good girl and I wanted her to think I was taking her directions, and I was. But I noticed that something in me was trying to escape putting this pen to paper. That something in me didn't want to put pen to paper. And here I was suffering. Here I was full of resentment and fear and anger and opinions and judgments and commentary about my life and your life and what has happened and what shouldn't have happened. And I had a lot to say when I had your ear. And I had a lot to say to myself in my own head. But when it came down to put it down, it's almost something in me was escaping it. And that was a great lesson. The lesson for me was to tell that to my sponsor and for her to say, that's okay. I understand. Check that out. That's the ego kind of just trying to keep you from seeing some truth. But something in you also wants to see it. So you're being honest about this. And she said, invite that God that you're building a relationship with a little bit more. Sit down with that pen and paper, say a prayer, and even if you're staring at an empty sheet, dedicate 30 minutes every day to writing, whether something comes out or not. Within 2 weeks, I was done writing. 2-3 weeks. In a short amount of time, for a first-time experience, I was done writing. Other experiences were precipitated by, I was just in enough pain, and I already had this experience with this tool, that I knew that there's something cathartic about putting pen to paper and about seeing it, it bringing it out of my thoughts and putting, making it real. This is what goes through my head. This is what I think. And also seeing that the resentments, someone had a pattern to them and how they were overlapping, because what they were really showing me is how I saw life. They weren't saying anything about the other person. This is why the first column is who I'm resentful at, but the second column is why. And the why tells me about how I relate to life. I want you to treat me a certain way. I want to be seen a certain way. I want to get certain things out of life. And if I don't, I'm going to feel some sort of way about it. I'm going to feel that I have been wronged. And so the second column, which he talks about, well, why? Why are you angry, Nick? Why is that pissing you off? Why are you frustrated at that? Why are you annoyed about that? What's the story that's creating that emotion? That was very important, because that's actually what I'm inventorying. The why is what I'm inventorying, not the person. The person's name can change a million times. The institution can change a million times. But it's the way I see life that needs changing. And in most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. So this 7 areas of self, 6 areas of self, whatever, there's many different 4-step inventories out there. But just paying attention to what the book talks about, it says how again, something about the way I design, something about I am the seven areas of self for me, well, they call it like instincts, right? These like basic instincts of survival in life. And like for me, my selfishness and self-centeredness shows up in a way where I just like think I know best what I need to have, and I know best what shouldn't happen. And so like when something different happens than what I think should happen, I get into fear. I go into fear. I get scared. And I don't think this fear is this like basic fear in life that we have, like of heights and like airplanes or certain things that are normal to survive. This is like psychological fear. This is like pure mental anxiety. This is like the stuff I tell myself, even without having necessarily the experience. So this is the third column, right? The third column is the seven areas of self, and I needed to see how these were impacted so that I can see how carrying this resentment was actually hurting me and making me unavailable and not present to day-to-day life. And then it says, on our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambition, or what I want? What I want is always affected. If it's on a resentment inventory, my ambition is always affected because my ambition is what I want. Our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with. We were usually as definite as this example. And then he gives examples of this. My prayer was, God, please help me with this. Show me what to do. Thy will not, mine be done. And it was also, please help me see the truth. And then it says, I'm resentful at Mr. Brown. The cause, his attention to my wife. It affects my sex relations, my self-esteem, how I see myself. And then in brackets, he put fear. Or told my wife of my mistress. I love that one. Damn, Mr. Brown, how dare you mess with my marriage. Of course it affects my sex relations and my self-esteem. And then he put fear in the brackets. Or Mr. Brown may get my job at the office, right? What does it affect my security, my financial security, and my self-esteem? And he put fear in the brackets again. And then they give two more examples. Mrs. Jones, why am I angry? She's a nut. She snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip. What does it affect? It affects my personal relationships with my friend, obviously, my self-esteem. And there's fear bracketed there. And then my employer. I love that. Why? They're unreasonable. Why? Because they want me to work, show up to work on time, put in 8 hours of honest work. I mean, just it really says about how I perceive life and how like grandiose I think I am and how important we tend to think we are in this lifetime. What, they're unreasonable, right? Unjust, overbearing, threatens to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account. I mean, who thinks like this? This is insane. Like, just let me steal from you. I need it more than you do. And leave me alone. Affects my self-esteem, my security for sure. And my wife. Why am I resentful? And my wife misunderstands and nags. She likes Brown, Mr. Brown. And she wants house put in her name. That's obviously pride is affected. And I would say pride is affected anytime someone likes me or not. My pride is affected. Personal and sex relations. And my emotional and financial security for sure. So those are some examples that they give. We went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Those are conditions for approaching this inventory. For me, the approach for the inventory was that I'm genuine and that I'm sincere and that I'm earnest. I think earnestness is something that they beg of us. They talk about it and how it works. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. So we have the three columns. Right? I see how these resentments are affecting these seven areas of self. The first thing apparent was that the world and its people were often quite wrong. So, is that apparent to me? Is a question for me. Is that apparent to me? It needs to be apparent. If it's not, I'm not seeing the value of the inventory yet. To conclude that others were wrong were as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves, or shame or regret. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. That's like a footnote, step three there, right? That's what they talked about up until this point. You know, me running the show and needing to stop playing God because it doesn't work. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. Because even if I'm right about my inventory, you know, I can see that, like, blame is like a major tool of the mind or the ego that prevents me from, like, really living life to the fullest and showing up in a very genuine and present way. The mind really takes me out of the present moment, so I can't really be available for what's in front of me, nor move from some more honest place within me, because I'm constantly wrapped up in my head, and my head is what's not happening. If I'm constantly in what's not happening, if I'm owned by a resentment from 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago, I'm not here. I'm not here. That owns me. I don't get to have relief. So what do you, even if I'm right, okay, I'm right, what now? Sometimes I tell that to people, okay, you're right, and now? I still need to find a way to be free and make myself available to here and now. To here and now. And for that, I need God's help, which the book has covered up until this point. I need to tap into the higher power. I need to go from the head to the heart. I need to find a way to soften the heart. I need to see the value of forgiveness or letting go or acceptance or ownership of my own life or a different pair of glasses to see things from a different perspective. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. That's pretty much kind of what I just talked about. And the question is that plain to me? Because I have met people, and I have been one of them, that, boy, do we enjoy some of our resentments. I mean, some of them are juicy, and they're like a great story to tell, and I'll get a lot of taps on the back. Oh, I can't believe. Really? Oh, you know what I mean? Some of us just enjoy them. Actually, we don't want to change. We don't want to let go of them. Who would we be without our resentments? Without me playing a victim or playing a martyr, depending on who I'm standing in front of, they can give me praise or tell me, oh, I'm doing the right thing, or blame somebody else. We love that stuff. You know? But do I see that is it plain to me that it disconnects me from the best life I could be living? And the one that is off connection. Because the truth is, I am disconnected. And I suffer from that. And is it plain to me that resentment is the number one offender? And that more alcoholics die from it than anything else? And that I'm spiritually cut off from connecting to the source of life? From feeling alive, feeling inspired. To the precise extent that we permit these. I am a co-conspirator in this thing. I totally play a part. And I think one of the ways that I permit this is by not just by trying to get others to agree with me and co-sign my resentments, but in believing them over and over and over again, talking about them just from the second column perspective, only about what they've done. Only about what's wrong with them. Taking other people's inventory. Never seeing my part in the dance. How I chose to look at something. What I did. What I failed to do. All of that is my part. My expectations. My assumptions. All of that stuff. So to the precise extent that I permit these, Do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, which is my solution to my alcoholism. But is that my hope? Maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience. We got to go from that, get away from the head, and we got to like embody the heart. I need to literally bring these resentments into my heart. This business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. I know this to be true. When I'm in anger, when I carry a resentment, I feel blocked. I feel it. My body responds. I don't feel inspired. I'm tired. I'm angry. Everything is annoying. Everyone is annoying. Everything is like a homework. I can't see the beauty in things and little things. I can't access the gratitude in me. I'm short, I'm cranky, I feel like I've been wrong. This is like human experience, guys. This is not just for the alcoholics, although we're like the electric version. The regular humans are like the acoustic version of this stuff. We're like the electric with, the extra bass, The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. You see, insanity kicks in prior to me having a drink. The insanity is that I convince myself of that first drink. That's the insanity. The mental state that precedes the relapse is that first drink. And with us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we have to be free of anger. That needs to be my mantra in life, because I still sometimes get angry. And there's nothing wrong with anger. And it's a regular human emotion. It can be sharp and it can be clear and it can be necessary. But to be in resentment with anger is to day in and day out relive and replay some story in my head that blocks me off. And I can't afford that. I just cannot afford it. I cannot afford that. And am I convinced of that? And am I clear on that? And do I want to be free from that? And do I know that if I don't get free from that, then I'm in a lot of trouble? The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. So we turn back to the list. We have those three columns. For why? For it held the key to the future. There's something in my inventory that's going to be incredibly informative to me. And it's going to be very valuable for me to see how I move in life and how I relate to life and how I see myself. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. I love that sentence, because the question is really, are you prepared to look at it from a different angle? And I needed to be willing to look at it from a different perspective, with a different set of eyes, with this God that I was building a relationship from the heart, with the prayers that I was doing as I was writing inventory, right? I needed to not see it, not be informed by the same mind that created the resentment. I needed to be willing to tell the truth. I needed to be willing to get quiet. I needed to be willing to pray. I needed to be willing to sit still. I needed to be willing to take my own inventory. That's the different angle. We begin to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real. And I love that he writes fancied or real, because one of my resentments was my dad abandoned me. My dad didn't abandon me. My family, my parents divorced. That's all that happened. Right? But the mind construed, right? This whole, he left me and it had something to do with me and I wasn't good enough, and that's why. And my dad was an alcoholic. He was an active alcoholic and a gambler. My parents divorced. They had their own story. They had their own dance. They had their own part to play in that marriage and how it ended, But somehow it served me more to be seen as a victim by you guys, to tell you my dad abandoned me. Or, depending on who I'm standing in front of, to be a martyr of that. Oh, look at that. I've been on my own from 16 years of age. Can you believe supporting myself? I don't really have a dad. You know what I mean? And so I needed to get honest. This is the honesty that we run from. But it's that kind of honesty that cuts through and makes me stand on my own two feet, which is what I always wanted, to be real and to be autonomous. And that's where freedom lies. If I want freedom, I need to be willing to tell the truth. And I needed to separate myself from that truth that my mind has been building for years, to preserve itself. And this is what they mean by with detachment. without regret, they tell us that we need to write this inventory, like a business that takes stocks. What kind of ideas or old ideas about life and myself am I carrying around that do not serve me? And maybe they're not correct. Have I ever even questioned if that's what relationships are about, or that's what parents are supposed to provide, or that's what, or that he really did that? Or do I really know that? Do you know, inventory is the first time that I was allowed to question my mind. I love that. Question my mind expanded my world a lot more than I was able to expand it on my own. Fancy the real had power to actually kill. Why? Because the resentment kills. It's the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. We read that before. How could I escape? How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol, and that's when I like put on my good girl shoes, like, I don't want to hate anybody. But you know, then yeah, I wake up at 6 in the morning to go pee, and I'm like arguing with the person who's not there. That person's not there, but I'm telling him everything I really think. And it's expletives, if you know what I mean. But like then I'm like, ah, oh, it's not good to hate, you know? Like, come on. You know, I on my own power, I couldn't. I studied philosophy. I was brought up well. I like to play a good girl and a nice girl. I tend to be a good girl and a nice girl. I have been a good girl and a nice girl. And boy, was I angry. And I couldn't wish it away. I couldn't pretend it away. I couldn't intellectualize it away. I couldn't even spiritualize it away with some literature that I had read on what's right and wrong. He was there. He was like burning me. Like I couldn't help it. You know? This was our course. So here's the answer. Here's the solution. Here is actually the solution to it. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Perhaps. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. So don't hold on. You know, not like, you know, in AA, sometimes you're like, oh, they're sick. You know, we say it like a little passive-aggressive with a little tinge of sarcasm, you know, like you're not sick. You know, like, you know, like, we're like so quick to judge others, man. I am. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, here's the great equalizer, like ourselves, were sick too. We ask God to, here's the prayer, right, for a different attitude. This is the prayer. They call it the sick prayer, anger prayer. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man like me, I added, like me. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Your will not mine be done, thy will be done. And this was repeated with every single resentment that I had between the third and fourth column. Because between the third and fourth column, I needed a shift. I needed a change. I needed to drop into the heart. I needed to soften the heart. I needed to include God more than ever. I needed to be willing to seek truth, regardless of whether I liked it or not, more than ever. And I needed a miracle. I needed a miracle that I haven't been able to give myself. I needed to be free. I needed to walk lighter through life. I needed to not have this in my head spinning around. There needs to be a shift between the third and the fourth column. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. And, you know, like, you start writing inventory, and something does shift as just a general part of four-step inventory. For me, yeah, I'm taking other people's inventory, but I'm, like, on a bunk bed, top bunk in a sober house, you know, with no cell phone, in a town I don't even know where I am, in massive debt, in early recovery. You know, it just puts things in perspective about my ability to live life successfully. You know, it puts things in perspective. It's humbling, right? and I know like that I should be dead and I'm saved, and I'm like, in, you know, like I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't know how this has anything to do with me not picking up a drink, but there's a willingness to listen to my sponsor and do this, right? And as I'm like, for the first time in my life, writing about the thoughts in my head, basically, and questioning them and reflecting on them and sitting with these prayers and contemplating things while I'm going to AA meetings and hearing you guys talk about all kinds of things that are so interesting and radical, something's shifting. Because I'm also taking my own inventory. And I am full of shame and regret and remorse and embarrassment about where I've landed. I went from six figures in New York City and like flying first class, you know, to a top bunk of a newcomer room in a small sober house in North Jersey with no cell phone, you know. And I'm seeing that, and I'm not trusting myself, right? Because I come into the rooms broken, knowing my mind lies to me, because it lied to me over and over and over and again that I can manage my drinking. And if it lied to me about drinking, why wouldn't it lie to me about my perception of people and things? Which also is brought into this inventory. I'm questioning my mind. So see, all of the experiences play a part by the time we get to the fourth step. And it says, okay, so here's the fourth column. It says, we avoid retaliation or argument. But why? Because it doesn't work. It just perpetuates it. My argument with life only perpetuated it. It didn't ever solve it. It didn't take it away. It didn't lower it. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. And I knew that I was sick too. So I wanted the same compassion that they were asking me to give to the people that wronged me, fancied or real. So that also kind of played a part in the softening of the heart. Like, I knew I made some bad moves. I knew I cheated, I lied, I stole. I knew I did the basic harms, you know? And so I was willing. Maybe there was one or two resentments that I couldn't see, but that's why we have sponsors, and we have the fifth step, and we have the six and seven, and we have the sobriety and the maturity that comes with going on. I just needed to see a little bit. I needed a an opening. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. This didn't make sense to me until it made sense to me, like everything else in the big book. It doesn't make sense until it makes sense. And usually it makes sense only when I have an experience with it. But it's not this fairy tale, like, I'm here to save everybody and be there for everybody. It's, I love this. God, life, love will show me and guide me how to be neutral with anyone I encounter. How to not take things personally with anyone I encounter. How to allow you to be where you're at and how you are. That's what that means to me. How to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Kind and tolerant view for me is to accept you where you're at, however you're at. To God's allowing you to be. Who am I to not? Referring to our list again and putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Right? And it's just like this picture, you know, like whoever I'm resenting and me in the picture, and now suddenly I like put something over them, and I look at, well, how did I move in this relationship? What were my expectations and assumptions in this relationship? Did I gossip? Did I lie? Did I cheat? Did I steal? Was I inconsiderate? All of those things is what selfishness and self-centeredness looks like. I could be using different words to point to that. How did I dance? Did I really show up? Was I really available? You know? And we start seeing how we contribute. How nothing happens to us, necessarily, but it happens. And that doesn't mean that they haven't wronged me. But I needed to see the human condition, and that I was part of that human condition as well. Where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid, and frightened? Where was I? It doesn't say was I. Where was I? There must be some area of this dance, of this relationship. And that's not only what I've done, but sometimes what I fail to do. Sometimes I fail to communicate, fail to put up boundaries, fail to be clear on certain things. Though situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where was I to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we were willing to set these matters straight. I mean, on page 67, he's already talking about all the way up to 9th amendment. He's talking about the 5th, 6th and 7th, 8th and 9th, in those last two, three sentences. There's already willingness as I write this inventory, the fourth step. This is just like a process that's opening me up and getting me closer to the heart. Because that fourth column is going to show me also a lot about me. It's going to show me a lot about me. And don't forget, we're taking stock honestly. If this business of Nicoletta, the action figure, is going to survive in life in the best way possible, it needs to take a look at what unsellable items she's using to maneuver through life. Because some of them are a failed system. And they don't work. Okay, next is fear. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer and the wife, because it underlies everything. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. I think fear for me is mental anxiety, psychological fear. It's the stories I tell myself about things that are not even happening that paralyze me and block me from being present and taking positive action. Or trusting. Why do I have fear? Because I don't have faith. And I'm relying on my own power, which constantly fails me. I actually know that I'm powerless, but I don't want to admit it. And so the mind is constantly looking for some sort of security. I want to know what's around the corner. I want certainty and I want security, but it doesn't have it. It knows it doesn't have it. And on that, when I rely on self, that's a failed system. And I will constantly be in anxiety because I don't trust life. And I don't trust people, and I know that I'm small, and so I'm not tapped into the wisdom of life. I don't trust that whatever is in front of me is supposed to be happening. I don't trust that there's some kind of a lesson that I need to learn from it. I don't trust or feel the presence of God in my life or next to me or near me, which makes me also feel very small and alone. And this just precipitates more and more fear and anxiety. It's an evil and corroding threat. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion chains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing because it steals our ambitions, our abilities to be in a relationship, to be honest, to be vulnerable, to... Like it's paralyzing. It just like paralyzes me. I mean, I don't want to speak. I have a major fear of public speaking. Anybody that knows me knows this about me. I mean, literally major fear. As an exercise in my faith in God, I show up. Nothing in me wants to do it. My heart's beating faster. I'm sweating. I want to cover up. I always put something on, like sweaters and something. I want to hide. Everything in me wants to hide. I don't want people looking at me. I think I need to perform. I think you're going to be disappointed. Like, all of this is happening in the mind. The devotion and the service to that power that saved me and that I have in my life, I serve from that place and I serve to that place, and that's why I show up, no matter how much I like it or not. If I listen to my mind, nobody would ever hear me speak. So despite the fear, I show up. And that's how I exercise faith. And, you know, 15 years ago, I couldn't even work for a week before I was asked to speak. Now, I might feel a little uncomfort when I sit at the front table for a few minutes. Like, it's still not my gig. It's not my jam. Some people are good, you know, meant for it. Some people are not. I have to, like, really show up. I have to have faith. Every time I show up, I literally think nothing's going to come out of my mouth, and then you can't shut me up. I can't even read the book. Like, I can't even finish a sentence. I have so much to say. But see what the mind does? The anxiety? All at the core of it
is I want to be aligned. I want you to see me a certain way. I want to be a good AA member. I want to do good in front of Cass, who I adore, and she's one of my heroes, and she's here. I want to do good by Mark, who booked me. You know, even though I think he keeps making a mistake by doing it. Do you know what I mean? You know what I mean? This is what the mind does. And it does that in all the forms of life. Relationships, jobs. If I didn't have faith, I wouldn't be sitting up here. If I didn't feel the presence of that God, I wouldn't be sitting up here. And that fear is only present when I give attention to the mind. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. We write them down. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, we ask ourselves, well, why do you have this fear? How do I contribute to this fear? What is the story I tell myself about this fear? Right? But it gives us the answer right away. It's a little tricky. It's like, wasn't it before self-reliance failed? It's like, why do you have this fear? Oh, because you're relying on self. That's why you have this fear, by the way. That's the answer. It actually answers it for us. But it's good. It was good for me to know, right? I have a fear of rejection. Right. Why? How did I set the ball rolling? Well, because I give you guys power to tell me who I am. I put it in human power and not God's power. If I put it in God's power or the depth of my being, I wouldn't need your approval or rejection. I would take it or leave it alone. You're allowed to have your own opinion. But how I feel about me would not be in your hands. But because I set the ball rolling by saying, in life, your opinion matters about who I am. You're going to tell me who I am and what I'm worth. Then I'll constantly be afraid in front of people. So it's good for us to see this stuff. This is what I mean by inventory will reveal to you how you see life. It will reveal to you how you see yourself. But it gives us an answer. It's because we are relying on self. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve this fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. And here's the solution. Well, perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. When am I on this basis? After the third step. I made this decision in the third step. I'm coming into the inventory with this power that I'm trying to make a relationship with. This power is with me all along. I'm just willing to acknowledge it now. I'm willing to communicate with it now. I'm willing to invite it more into my life. I'm willing to look for it more. Right? I trust that power which is infinite rather than myself which has found to be insufficient. We are in the world to play the role this power assigns. That's my employer now. Just to the extent, and here's the condition, that number one, I do as I think he would have me. So if I say yes to a speaking commitment, despite my fear, my God would like me to move out of integrity and be true to my word. Because, do you see what I'm saying? He would like me to show up, to be courageous, to show what he can do. So that's, I show up from that place. And humbly rely on him when I get in a real tizzy. Am I really acknowledging the presence of God in my life? And am I really remembering, no matter how I'm perceiving any situation that's currently going on in my life, no matter how scary it is or how alone it might make me feel, do I invite that God into my life? Am I acknowledging the presence of that God? That God or life or love somehow knows what it's doing, even though I can't see the big picture right now. Does he enable me to match calamity with serenity? It doesn't say calamity will be gone. It's saying that I will be able to allow life to be life, and I will join and align with life with an ability to be neutral and stand still in the midst of life's storms. What are life's storms? Heartaches, medical conditions, financial insecurities, loss of employment, he left, grief, the things that scare us. And the things that bring me closer and closer to my fear of dying, which is the ultimate fear. And the biggest fear I saw in my inventory was the fear of dying. And all the other fears stemmed from it. Like, I know I'm going to die, and I don't know when it's going to be, and I'm completely powerless over it. And we're all like, in some way or another, lack of power is our dilemma. I'm like, not in control. That's my biggest problem. That's the mind's biggest problem. It wants control, I want control. And everything about life and everything about alcoholism has been designed to have me be surrendered and let go and trust and have faith. And that takes courage. Not certainty, courage. And all men of faith have courage. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. Do I trust my God? I didn't trust you, but do I trust God? And if I trust God, then I will trust life and everything that shows up in front of me. I never apologize for God. Instead, I let Him demonstrate, here's the fear prayer, through us what He can do. We ask Him, I ask Him, God, please remove this fear that I have, fear of whatever fear I've noted on that inventory, and direct my attention to what You would have me be. It doesn't say for me to do anything. It wants me to get still. It wants me to trust God. I need to be more trusting of God. I need to have more faith. Or I need to be practicing the spiritual principles by being the spiritual principles. Spiritual principles are of spirit. We need to be them. I don't do them. I be them. And from that place I do. That's why it's pointing to being. At once we commence to ask for fear. So when I'm freaking out about a speaking commitment, I need to be in my gratitude. The moment I tap into the gratitude in my heart that I have for this power that saved my life, I have no choice but to sit up here and be of service to AA. Whether I like it or not. Whether I want to or not. Whether I think I should or not. Because I trust God that placed me here. I trust that God worked through Mark to ask me. I trust that because I'm here, I trust the reality, the great reality of what's happening in front of me is what's meant to be happening, whether I like it or not. Anything other than that is my argument or my fear. Now about sex, and I don't know, can I cover sex in 4 minutes? I don't have to cover sex. Go ahead. Now about sex. Come on, we all want to talk about sex a little. Many of us needed an overhauling there. That's an understatement. But above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes. Perhaps one set of voices cried that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation or reproduction. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail or express sorrow, the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. That's very Freudian. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. Well, here's a pointer. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter, or that's a judge, of anyone's sex problem. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about that? And then it goes into sex and harm inventory. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past, and I really don't think it's about sex. It's not about sex. It's about relationships. And oftentimes it's a power play, or it's about control, or it's about how I see myself as a woman, or how I see the opposite sex, or how do I weaponize sex, or how do I use sex to get what I think I want or need, or how do I, you know, like these are the things I need to be looking for. I need to be looking for those kinds of dynamics, and I need to be looking how my instincts are affected based on that, what I have been taught, and what my judgments of it are. And how do I show up in intimate personal relationships? And then we trail from those into all other relationships where I might have caused harm. And then it says, where was I? And again, it says where, not have you, but there's absolutely no way that you had sex ever in your life with somebody and you were not selfish, dishonest, afraid or something. I mean, come on, like that's sticky stuff, money and sex. It's like a condition for alcoholism. These two have to be sticky and you have to have some part to play in these two. Where had we been selfish, dishonest or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Because usually both parties do get hurt. Did we unjustifiably, I love this, unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Who even thinks like that? Awakened people ask questions like that. I remember the first time I read that, I was like, did I unjustifiably arouse suspicion, bitterness? Hell yeah! It's a game strategy to get what you want in a relationship. You know what I mean? But I've never used those words like that. I've never even seen it like that. Like, you know what I mean? I thought everybody else was doing it. Again, old ideas about life and what my role is and how I play it and my stage character. Where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? It doesn't say what could I have done instead. It says what should I have done? What would have been the right thing to do? What would you advise your most loved one to do? What would you advise your daughter or your son to do? You know, sometimes, like, you know, women come to me and you know, they sponsor other women. And they're like, I don't know what to do. Well, if your sponsor came to you, what would you tell them? And then suddenly you have the answer. Because the answers are within us. We know the truth. We just need somebody to point it a little bit. That's what I needed. We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound. Sane and sound, or sober. That's a sober ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? And that's the bottom line that it comes to. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. I need to rip out the root. I cannot be moving selfishly in relationships, any relationship. And I need to check myself. And I'll make mistakes and I'll forget and I'll do it innocently and all of that. And maybe sometimes I won't see it and sometimes I need to ask Cass and I need to ask the women in my life, you know, is this right? What should I do? And all of that. But that's why we have each other and we have our tribe and we have the tools and we have inventories and we have sponsors and we have people that we spiritually grow with. Because if I understand that my life is based on my spiritual growth, then I will do everything in my power to consistently check myself. I need to check myself. I have a part to play. How am I moving? What am I valuing? From what place am I coming? We ask God, so here's the prayer. God, please help me mold my ideal and help me to live up to that ideal. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. When instincts are not overused or whatever the word is, then, you know, they're natural. They're a way that to move through life in a more effortless way. It just traveling lighter through life. I think this whole idea is to travel lighter through life because then I don't need to, like, get loaded. I got nothing to escape. Everything is welcome. And I want to be a good part of life. I want to participate in life. I want to be alive. I don't want to take it for granted. It is a gift. It is precious. There's always beauty if I have the eyes for it. And then every moment becomes like a gift. And every challenge becomes an offering to God. Show me how we can get through this. You know? I wrote out an ideal, and I remember even in the ideal learning something from the very first ideal I ever wrote. I remember being asked what I'm looking for in somebody, and you know, it's, you know, said all those cute little things that we do in our first inventory. And I remember my sponsor asking me, well, which one of these characteristics, you know, that you want him to be generous, or you want him to spiritually grow, or you want him to be selfless, or whatever it is there, well, which ones you're lacking in? And she had me, like, underline them, and she said, well, why don't you grow towards them? Because, you know, there was this whole idea of, like, I will attract who I am and what I put out, that we have some shared values or that we have some same ways of looking at life, but I need to be that first. I need to walk the talk. I need to be everything that I'm looking in you or looking for you to be, no matter who you are. Everything I want you to be like. Am I like that? Can I strive to be more like that? Can I grow towards that?
Whatever our ideal turns to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we already in the inventory, before you even write your fifth step, they're like, you should be feeling some regret. I mean, I wrote my fourth step and I was like in tears. By the time I was done with the sex and harm inventory, like something was hitting me already. Something was shifting me. Something was like, holy shit. You know? Oh my God. You know, that sucks. Oh, I'm embarrassed. Provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what I should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. Nobody else answers it for us. We sit in silence. We look for guidance from stillness. God alone can judge our sex situation, not anybody in the rooms of AA. Counsel with person is desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. You'll know what's hysterical when it's just extreme. Hysterical is some sort of extreme. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. But this is only a half truth. Depends on us and our motives. Check your motives in general. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we'll have learned our lesson. Here's a heavy warning. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we're quite sure to drink. That's a strong, strong statement from the Big Book of Alcoholics. We're quite sure. They're like guaranteeing a relapse. If you are, your conduct of any kind involving other people is, you are not sorry for it, and if you continue to harm others and be selfish, you are going to get loaded. It's only a matter of time. We are not theorizing, these are facts out of our experience. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal. Earnestly. Earnestly is a pointer. For guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, sobriety of the mind, emotional sobriety, mental sobriety, clarity. And for the strength to do the right thing, because the right thing is sometimes I need courage to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them, expecting nothing in return. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge or the urgent urge when to yield would mean heartache. And in my most difficult times in relationships, I turned my attention towards service and sponsees, and it literally saved my life. Saved my life. Because I think that certain relationships can really drive us to feel such powerlessness and such disappointment and heartbreak and difficulty and loneliness that, like, that's the time we need to even, like, enter the circle of AA even more so, I think. That's been my experience. If we have been through about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. We listed and analyzed. We forget. We need to analyze our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. Do I see their futility, that they're useless, pointless, that they're literally pointless in my life? They bring about no change, and they do not serve me in any positive way. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. Have I started to see how destructive it is to carry this burden of negativity around all day long, to wake up with it, to go to bed with it, to lose sleep over it? And have I begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, even the ones I don't like? For we look on them as sick people. Do I look on them as sick people to this day when I don't like them? We have listed the people on We have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. Step 8. In this book, you read again and again that faith or God did for us what we could not do for ourselves, right? That's our step 2. That's our willingness to step into the unknown. Something else is operating and paving the road for us because we have failed to do so in our own power. We hope you're convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. So what stands in the way of the most intimate relationship with this God or truth or love? My self-will, my ideas, my thinking about life and myself and others. If you have already made a decision, third step decision, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, the things that are really preventing you from living your fullest life, right? That's the fourth step. You made a good beginning. You're still in the comfort of your home. You haven't even been a free-range alcoholic yet. You're like still sitting on a bed in a sober house or something, you know, counting sober days, like, you know. You know what I mean? We haven't even faced anybody. We haven't even done any major work. And this is what they're telling us. This is the easy stuff. This is the stuff you do in the comfort of your home. Maybe you face your sponsor. Maybe you attend a few meetings. You haven't even put on the pants of courage yet. That being said, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. And then in the original manuscript it said, are you willing to go on? Thanks for letting me share.